Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. So imagine writing your very first novel. A small independent press publishes your book, and a year later, two major publishing houses love it so much, they start a bidding war. Well, that's the story of my guest today, Jenny Lacote, and that's what happened when she wrote The Girl from the Channel Islands. Inspired by a true story, The Girl from the Channel Islands is about the journey of a young Jewish woman trapped on Britain's Isle of Jersey during World War II under Nazi occupation. It's a tale of resistance, of friendship, love, courage, and survival. So let me tell you a little about my guest and we'll bring her on. Jenny was born on Jersey in the Channel Islands, where her parents were raised under German occupation. I mentioned at the start that this is Jenny's debut novel, but she's been a prolific writer for 30 plus years for various publications, TV, film. Her screenplay, Another Mother's Son, was made into a feature film in 2017. Today we discuss Jenny's background and the bidding war on The Girl from the Channel Islands, as well as some of the true stories she ran into during her research, where she took creative license and why, and what it took to turn from successful screenplay writer to successful novelist. Jenny's joining me today via Zoom, and here's my guest, Jenny Lacote, with The Girl from the Channel Islands. Jenny Lacote, welcome, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, congratulations on this book. I think it's going to be a huge hit. This was a book published last year under a different name, as I understand it. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. It came out under the title of Hedy's War in the UK last year. Unfortunately, because we thought we'd been very smart and we picked the anniversary, the 75th liberation, actually, of Liberation Day in Jersey. Unfortunately, of course, that turned out to be 6 weeks into our lockdown.
Right.
So it wasn't quite the party occasion that we'd hoped for, but no, it's been a reasonable hit here, but it's been a huge success in the States. I mean, we're on the New York Times bestseller list, which is absolutely mind-boggling.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And I heard that you had a bidding war on this from the original publisher to HarperCollins, is that right?
Yeah, there was a little bidding war on it at the beginning, and I'm very happy that I went with HarperCollins. They've done me proud on this. But when the a small independent picked this up in the UK a couple of years ago, I certainly never thought we would end up here.
Right. Well, it's an amazing story and you have an amazing background. So I want to just touch a little on that before we get into the story, The Girl from the Channel Islands. You've just got such an interesting background there, and I'm sure that all of it has fed into bringing you to where you are today. You're a former stand-up comic, presenter, actor, feature writer for newspapers and magazines, spent 30 years writing all kinds of feature film and drama, television drama. You had a movie come out a couple of years ago. What brought you to this place to write this book?
Well, you know, I think all writers would probably say, I have no idea how I actually got to this place. You sort of get blown by the wind, I think, a lot of the time. I started off as a stand-up in the 80s. It was a great time to be a stand-up in the UK because the whole alternative comedy circuit was just starting up and it was very exciting. And then I moved into comedy writing after that, which seemed a fairly natural progression. And then from sitcoms and sketch writing, I went into more soap and drama work. And then I loved history when I was at school. And I loved factually based drama. So I kind of got into writing factually based historical stuff and doing standalones. And then I think it was 2012, decided that I would really like to tell the story of my family in the Jersey occupation. I'd just kind of done enough serious drama and historical drama then to feel that I could probably tackle it. So, yeah, and that became Another Mother's Son, which is out on Prime in the States at the moment.
Yeah, that's just come out on Prime, right? So, let's talk a little bit about Jersey, because a lot of Americans won't know what Jersey is, where Jersey is. But it's a beautiful island, the British Isles. They're just so beautiful. You're talking specifically of the Channel Islands when we talk of Jersey and Guernsey.
Very few people actually know where they are outside of Britain. In fact, a lot of people in Britain aren't exactly sure where they are. The Channel Islands are a very small group of tiny islands. Jersey's the biggest, and it's only 9 by 5 miles. And they are geographically much closer to France. So they're only 14 miles off the coast of France and about 80 miles south of England. So, when the Nazis began making enormous and very rapid headway across France in 1940, the islands suddenly realised that they were in a very dangerous position. And because the British government weren't able to defend them and withdrew the troops so that the islands were left completely undefended, and as a result, they became the only British territory to be occupied
right.
by the Nazis in World War II.
Must have been a terrifying experience for the people who lived there, really. And I know you were born long after the island was liberated, the island of Jersey was liberated. But I'm assuming that it impacted the way that you grew up because your parents would have grown up in it, etc.
Absolutely. And the funny thing is, when I was growing up, I thought that I was born years after the war. But of course, as an older person now, I'm looking back and realising that 15 years after the end of the occupation was nothing.
Right.
Certainly to those people, to my grandparents who had raised, on both sides of the family, had raised their families and raised children under those circumstances. And to both my parents who had grown up as kids under occupation, it was very recent history. And I think there was quite a lot of trauma that was still going on amongst those families as a result of it. But of course, growing up as a kid in the 1960s, I used to go and play hopscotch on the top of the old German bunkers and had no real idea of the significance of them and what they meant to people only a few years earlier.
Right, right. So let's look at the book because it's a lovely story. And I think it's probably very heartfelt from the amount of work that you put into this. It's described as a tale of friendship, love, courage, and survival. Fair description?
I hope so. Yeah, that's certainly what I was aiming for. I mean, at its heart is a Romeo and Juliet love story because it's based on the true story of Hedy, who arrived in Jersey in 1938, having escaped the Anschluss, and became trapped there, and being Jewish, because she was in an incredibly vulnerable position, of course. But she managed to survive by working for the Germans, which was extraordinary, given that she was classified as Jewish. And she managed to have this relationship with this German officer, who, when she had to go into hiding, a couple of years later, helped to keep her alive by bringing her food. So that's the kind of the story at its heart, but it's also about her relationship with Dorothea, who is a real woman who was who looked after her and was in fact awarded a Yad Vashem award 5 or 6 years ago, which is when the story really came to public attention.
Right. In the acknowledgements, you thanked your husband, of course, for his support while you were writing this book. He's a writer too, right?
He is a writer too, and that comes in very handy, particularly in lockdown when you need an editor. it's quite handy, although sometimes, you know, you have to cook him something nice if you want him to do the work. he's been a writer for years. In fact, we met actually writing on the same sitcom together in the early 90s.
Oh, fine.
And he read the early drafts of the book and gave me some useful notes. So, yeah, it does come in very handy having a being in the same business.
Yeah, and so you thanked him in the acknowledgements for putting up with your tantrums and your proclamations that it's impossible to write this story. So what made you want to write about Hedy Barcoo in particular?
Well, as I say, the story came to public attention about 2015, 2016, when Dorothea was given this posthumous award. And I had previously written Another Mother's Son, so I had done a lot of work, a lot of research on the occupation. But of course, the difference between a novel and a screenplay is a much tighter format. And within those sort of 90, 100 pages, there's an awful lot of material. There simply isn't time to get in. And when I discovered this story, I thought that it was kind of not only a great Channel Island story that wasn't very well known at that stage, but also a perfect opportunity to kind of use all the other background material that I hadn't really had a chance to get into the film so much.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided to tackle it, but I'd only had one attempt at a novel before, which was 20 years ago. And that was a disaster. I mean, that novel is now, you know, burned to the bottom of the garden. I couldn't get an agent for that one.
Yeah.
So I wrote this, you know, honestly, fully intending that it would probably never get published. And I thought if I was lucky enough to get it published, it, you know, might get a little indie publisher in Britain and sell a couple of thousand copies. So this success has been extraordinary. But that was why I struggled so much with it, because writing a novel was a whole new experience for me. And it's very different to writing
yes.
the screen.
Yes, absolutely. And also you're writing about a real person and you're fictionalizing, you're trying to get into her head and her thought processes to tell her story.
We had to fictionalize. I had to fictionalize a lot because only the bones of the story are known. We know when Hedy arrived. We know what she did. We know that she had this relationship with Kurt, and we know that she had this relationship with Dorothea, who was married to Anton. So the relationships within the story are true, but what we don't know is how those people met or how the relationships developed or how they felt about each other or why they did the things they did. We just know what happened when. So there was a lot of space for fictionalization in that. And you know, that then you sort of have to rely on a combination of trying to put yourself in that position a little bit and also your own information that you've researched about the occupation and trying to figure out what you think is realistic.
Right, because there's very few people alive who could actually, you know, who probably knew her for one thing and who could tell you.
Well, Hedy never spoke about it after the war. She never spoke about it. And Kurt, sadly, didn't live for many years after the war. So, yes, you're reliant on a few basic facts and little bits of information here and there and some documented evidence. So, as opposed to my family story, where there was actually quite a lot of evidence and quite a lot of people knew exactly what had happened and knew the details of the story. So, but either way, if you're writing a fictionalized account, then at some point you do have to take some leaps of faith and to fictionalize it and to create a character that you think is realistic within that environment.
Yeah. So tell me how you got into the character of Hedy enough to write about her. Where did that begin for you?
Well, I guess what I thought was, I knew that she'd escaped the Angelus. She was very young. She was only about, I think, 19 or 20 when she escaped, and maybe 21 when she arrived in Jersey. So she was a very young woman, and she was on her own. She'd left with her sister, but she'd parted company with her sister en route. And I think her original intention had actually been to go to the States, but for a variety of reasons, probably money and visas and stuff like that, she never made it. So you have to figure out that person is very tough. And then not only that, but we know that she lied. This is all in the book, of course, but she lied to the aliens officer who said that they considered her to be Jewish. And she tried to pretend that she wasn't Jewish, obviously, in order to save herself.
Right.
And she didn't get away with that. And then, of course, she gets this job with the Germans and then steals from them in order to help her local community. So all these things add up to someone who is very tough, but also someone who I think is not going to be a soft character. And also, I'm not interested in writing, you know, Disney princesses who are, you know, sweet and kind all the time. I'm you know, the people that I like and respect tend to be scratchy and a bit punchy and difficult. And I think Hedy had to be a scrappy person because of what she went through. And I think that makes her much more interesting, and I think it makes it much more realistic.
Right. And then her friend Dorothea and her husband Anton, I mean, how much could you find out about them, if anything?
Well, again, we really know very little about, apart from the fact that they got married, and we know that the wedding wasn't attended by the family, and that Dorothea basically lived with her grandmother after the war. So we know enough to know that there would have been problems, we think, because, of course, as an Austrian, Anton would have been classed by the locals as a German. And he was drafted into the German army, even though he wasn't in any way German as far as he saw it, I presume. He worked in this Austrian bakery. So he would have had Dorothea particularly would have had a very hard time marrying him. And we just assume that it was a love match and that she just kind of took the flak from it. But At the end of the war, when she married Frank quite quickly afterwards, you do wonder if there'd been some issues. I don't want to say too much and give too much.
No.
But yeah, so it's trying to piece something together which seems realistic, given the known fact, and then trying to fill in the gaps, which is what any sort of historical fiction is, really, I suppose.
Yes. I know from reading reviews, I always look at, you know, what other people are saying about the book too. And I know from that people really felt a sense of place with Jersey, with your descriptions of Jersey and the island. And I've heard you say, I hope this fictionalized account of Hedy's experience provides some insight into a world that few are left to provide firsthand, and brings understanding and inspiration to future generations. And I think that's so important, because I was reading a social commentary last week where, you know, they said, and I hadn't really thought about this, but we do have a whole generation who were born after 9/11 and have no idea or little idea of what it was all about and why it was so significant. So storytelling like this is important, because it draws in people who wouldn't sit down with a history book.
Well, that's right. I think it might have been George Bernard Shaw who said it's only through fiction that facts become instructive. And I think fiction can often be a more powerful way of telling a story than a history book or a documentary. And you're right. I mean, I think there's lots of people who are not maybe not very well educated about that. That's probably a schools issue, that don't necessarily know very much about what happened during that period. Certainly the Channel Islands occupation isn't especially well known, even in the British Isles.
Right.
And there was quite a frightening statistic quite recently that a lot of people, something like 25% of people under 25 weren't sure exactly what the Holocaust was. Mm-hmm. Many of them had only read stuff on social media and weren't even sure if it was real or not. So when you start reading stuff like that, you feel a responsibility to tell a story and to say, look, you know, it is that cliche, but we are doomed to repeat it if we don't understand it.
Yes.
And I think we've all, even in the last couple of months, seen enough political activity to know what can happen, and very quickly. So yeah, it's I think it's really important to tell those stories and to try and make them come to life.
Yeah, well, I grew up in Birmingham, the middle of the country, the middle of the British Isles.
Right, I went to university there.
I saw you went to university. It's a small world, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, and my parents were war babies. And so I heard many stories from grandparents and great-grandparents and my parents about, you know, having to go down to the bomb shelter in the middle of the night and why the resistance was so important. But I remember getting your book first off and thinking, how come I don't know about the Channel Islands? But as I went through it, it started coming back. There were stories I'd just forgotten because they're not taught in school, as you said.
Yeah, that's right. And actually, one of the things that when the film came out here, when Another Mother's Son came out in the UK in 2017, and various friends saw the film, and the thing that surprised me more than anything was how many of them said, I had no idea about this. They didn't know that Russian slave workers had been brought over to work on the fortifications, and that people had, like my great aunt, who's the heroine of my film, that people had sheltered them and looked after them at great personal risk to themselves. They didn't know that people were starved and deprived, and they had their radios taken away, so mm-hmm. they had no communication contact. And a lot of that is completely unknown to them. And, you know, these are a lot of my friends who were kind of, you know, teachers and media people, and they didn't know anything about it. So it was kind of surprising that it seems to have slipped through the net. And I'm hopefully, you know, that these projects go some way to address that.
Yes. What surprised you the most when you were doing research for your novel?
I suppose that the level of deprivation. There were lots of individual stories that you come across which really get to you. And actually, I was very fortunate because my grandmother, as I say, raised her children during the war. And about 15 years ago, before she died, I managed to sit her down one day with a tape recorder and actually talk to her and get some information out of her about those stories, because I knew that this was probably going to be my last chance. And she told me a fantastic story of the day the bombs came, that the bombers flew over, because the Germans didn't know that the islands had been left undefended. They thought they were still militarized. So they bombed the harbor and the trucks on the quay. And my dad was 5 years old at the time, and he apparently rushed out into their backyard with his little tin hat and his little tin gun.
Oh, bless.
And he was shooting at the sky, going pop, 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 going, "Oh, don't worry, Mum, I'm going to get those Germans for you." And my gran had to go out and say, "Sweetheart, it's not a game. I'm afraid you've got to come in, because these are real planes and real bombs."
Oh.
So there's lots of stories like that, and stories she told me about trying to sew on a button when they had no electricity. And they were trying to fix their kids' clothes so they could go to school the next day. And they had this little sort of coke light. You had to drop something onto it and it would flare for a few seconds, and you could do a couple of stitches in that time. Those kind of stories are the things that really bring it home to you about how frightening it was. I mean, there's stuff like that going on in the world right now.
Yes.
In different countries. But the fact that your own family went through it is it kind of brings it home to you.
Yes, I used to love those stories myself. One of my favorites was my grandmother would make sure my mom and her brother were down in the bomb shelter, which was at the bottom of their garden. And then she'd go back and get the last little bit of whatever she needed to take down there. And then all the way down the garden, she'd raise her fist up to the air and be swearing at the bombers as they were coming by. And I can imagine her doing that because she was so spunky. They definitely had a spunkiness about them back then. So,
yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So we talked a little about the, you know, there's a huge difference between writing a screenplay and writing a novel. What were some of the biggest challenges for you transitioning from screenplay to novel writing?
Well, it was a struggle, and I actually saw a tutor for two or three sessions at the beginning, just to try and get a handle on it. Really, I think the issue for me was, obviously, when you're writing a screenplay, you give so much to the actors to do. You just give a stage direction and everything is implicit in the line. But of course, when you're writing prose, you have to explain the entire thought process. You have to do the actor's work as well and the director's work. And suddenly you're doing about five people's jobs, whereas right. I used to just, you know, produce a script. You do get more control over what you do creatively because it's less collaborative, but then you have a lot more responsibility in some ways. So, I found it a struggle, and trying to figure out how much description you gave. Do you ramble on with description? Do you just give a little bit? Is that enough for the reader to have a sense of where they are? So if people are saying that they are getting a real sense of Jersey and a real sense of place, then that's great, because it means I've hopefully got it about right.
Right. Right. And so you're already a seasoned writer. So how did writing the book help you grow as a writer?
I don't know if you ever, I mean, you do grow as a writer, but I don't think you've ever grown, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, definitely.
I think you constantly shift and change. And probably if I was writing this book now, you know, 2 years later, maybe I would do it slightly differently. I know that I'm a great plotter. I like to plot things out and know exactly what I'm doing in advance, although obviously things change and morph a little bit as you move on. I don't know. I think it's probably too early to tell what I've learned from this. I'm just working on a second book at the moment. And although you have a little bit more confidence, because if you've had some success, then you think, well, somebody believes I can do this. So that does help to a certain extent. But on the other hand, I don't think this book has been any easier to do. And then sometimes you think, oh, maybe I'm just using the same tricks. Maybe I need to learn some new stuff here.
Right.
So yeah, every time you start up that hill, you know, it's just as exhausting as it was last time.
I agree with you. You know, I write nonfiction, but I totally agree with you. And I've talked to so many writers who've said the same thing. You know, they've got, you know, 30, 40, 50 novels under their belt. And they say it's like writing the first one every time.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, as I say, confidence is helpful, but I think it's overplayed as a useful tool. I think sometimes it can work against you if you are overconfident when you approach something. So, yeah, it is just, yeah, it's starting again every time.
Okay. So, Jenny, I want to throw out three words for you and just get your instant response to what they mean to you, okay? So the first one is discipline.
Discipline means sitting down in front of your computer every day, or at least most days, and getting on with it. There's a fantastic quote from, I got a book of writer's quotations, and I can't remember who it was who said this, but somebody said, how do you get inspired every day? And he said, I get inspired every day by looking at the gas bill. And I think discipline is just getting on with it and doing the work and, you know, knowing when you need to show it to somebody else and assuming that you will have to do many drafts.
Mm. What about creativity? What does that mean to you?
Creativity is a hard one. People always talk about people in the creative industries. And I think, well, the people in the creative industries are largely the ones who got lucky. I think everyone is creative. I think most people are creative in some form, whether or not that's making a, you know, sewing a beautiful quilt or cooking a fantastic meal or finding beauty in the countryside. I think everyone is creative. And I always get uncomfortable when people talk about the creative industries as if those people are somehow separate. We're the ones who were fortunate to have made a living at it.
Yeah, I love that definition for you. And what about success? How do you define success?
Oh, that's a tricky one. I don't know. I suppose success, I would say, is probably the approval of your peers, I think. If other writers like your work, I think that, for me, is the nicest thing. I was very fortunate with the book to, it went out to a number of very successful authors who gave me some lovely quotations, and that meant a great deal. So, success for me is feeling that you've produced something that you don't think you could have done any better, and that other people whose work you respect agree with you.
Lovely. Well, Publishers Weekly said that readers will be riveted, and I'll read another one of those quotes that you got from Glynis Peters, author of The Secret Orphan, a captivating story of trust and betrayal, courage, survival, and forbidden love. And it's been awesome talking with you. Would you give out your website real quick, please, Jenny?
Yeah, it's jennylecote.com. And there's just a few little details about my past and a couple of quite dodgy pictures as well.
I love that, about your past. All right, so the book is called The Girl from the Channel Islands. And again, jennylecote.com is the website. And a final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today?
Well, if you do go out and buy the book, it would be great if you could support your independent publishers, because I think small independents have suffered a lot during lockdown. And it would be, I mean, if you buy the book anywhere, that's lovely for me, but it would be particularly nice if you can support a local bookseller.
Excellent. Jenny Lacote, thank you for being with us today. Appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you for having me.
If you have questions, comments, or feedback regarding today's podcast, you can reach me on our website at conversationslive.net. Thanks for joining us today. We'll have a new podcast go live next Wednesday. Until then, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.